Well, the statistics are still being written on this year's wildfires. We have one dead in Hornbrook's Klamathon fire, 8 people and over 1,000 homes lost in the Carr fire in Redding. Yet another major fire, the Klondike fire, burning in the Kalmiopsis region and revisiting scenes of older megafires. California's insurance commissioner says this year's fire losses in that state are $845 million, and the meter's still running. Cal Fire's requested a major infusion of dollars from the California legislature because this year's fires have burned through their funds, pun intended. Our region has had some of the worst air in the nation this summer for weeks on end, especially in Jackson, Josephine, and Shasta counties. We've had canceled performances at the Shakespeare Festival, the Brit Festival, and the list goes on and on. It's become common to hear people call this the new normal. There's great disagreement about what to do about our forest lands to lessen the impact of catastrophic fires, but there is solid agreement on one thing. We need to have a serious discussion about it. Oregon Representative Pam Marsh is convening a fire summit on Saturday at Southern Oregon University to talk about many aspects of coping with wildland fires, from forest management to public health to the economy. And in advance of that summit, we thought it might be useful to have a discussion about what the old normal has looked like. And toward that goal, we've invited three guests with significant forest fire experience to discuss how we got here and what a more resilient forest landscape might look like. First, we want to welcome Don Ferguson, who's worked for both the Forest Service and BLM and has just completed his 50th. That's a 5 and a 0. Is that right, Don?
Yeah, that's right. Can't deny it.
50th year working on wildland fires. He just yesterday closed the doors on the Joint Information Center in Southern Oregon. Don's going to be facilitating one of the panels at Representative Marsh's Fire Summit. Mark Obey also joins us. He's the executive director of the Lomacotsi Restoration Project, an Ashland-based nonprofit that works on various ecosystem restoration programs in the region, including the Ashland Forest Resiliency Project. And he's also going to be participating in the summit Saturday. Good morning, Marco.
Good morning.
And finally, Carrie Metlin joins us, who's a forest ecologist with the Nature Conservancy. And their new report really is what kind of spurred this particular segment on the exchange. They just released a report that looks at the history of fire in Rogue Basin forests. And Carrie, let's start with you and that study just released by the Nature Conservancy. It goes all the way back to the 1600s. How did you do that?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's exciting to be here speaking with all of you. And just this study, which actually is peer-reviewed, published in the Forest Ecology and Management Journal, we looked all the way back to the 1600s by, to be a little campy about it, asking the trees what they'd experienced. So what you may or may not know is that when a fire burns through the forest, it doesn't necessarily kill all the trees. In fact, if it's a lower severity fire, most of the trees might just stay intact, and especially if they're big old trees with thick bark. But if those big old trees with thick bark get damaged, that bark gets damaged, then they start to be damaged by future fires. And those fires form what are called scars in the growth rings of those trees. So we went to old, dead trees, and we would take a section of that tree, and we'd look at the fire scars and how those relate to the growth rings in those trees. And that tells us when fires burned, and we recorded on those particular trees.
So a typical person would say, well, you can use tree rings to, you know, you can count the tree rings and see how old a tree is, but those rings actually tell you a lot more information.
Absolutely. So how fast a tree grows determines how big that growth ring is. And you can then cross-date, meaning accurately date when a particular growth ring was laid down, by looking at patterns of good and bad years across thousands of trees. So you look for really bad droughts that happened at discrete intervals across time. Once you've cross-dated that tree, you know when the growth rings were laid down, then you can look at when fires scarred that tree, and you can develop a fire history for a given site. So what we would do is we'd collect about 5 of these fire scar samples at a given site, 10 fire scar samples at a given site, and then we'd look at when fires were recorded on those trees. We did that for 13 sites across the Rogue Basin, and it gave us a fire history, like we said, going back to this about 1650. Some of them where we didn't have as rich of a record have a shorter fire history. Some of them have a longer fire history.
And so what were the findings? I mean, what can you give us a capsule of what the history showed?
I sure can. The bottom line is that these actually very diverse but dry forests, so they're in dry mix conifer, moist mix conifer, mixed evergreen forest, going all the way over towards Cave Junction, basically from Ashland to Cave Junction. They saw very frequent fire, about every 8 years on average, and that of those fire return intervals that we observed, 90% of them fell between 3 and 30 years. So that's incredibly frequent fire. There's some variability around when fires would return. It wasn't every 8 years, everywhere, every time, but the central tendency was 8 years. And there weren't very long periods without fire. We have more results, but that's kind of like the take home that you could really apply to thinking about how do you manage forests in our region if we want to be thinking about how frequently was Mother Nature and the Native Americans, how are they stewarding a landscape that was resilient to historically frequent fire?
So we hear from historical records and that Native Americans managed the landscape frequently with fire. Mm-hmm. We've had a number of features here on the Jefferson Exchange about that very subject and about how some of the tribes, especially in the Klamath River Basin, are returning to sort of traditional fire management techniques. Is there anything in your study that shows how frequently the fires were set by Native Americans versus the frequency of, say, lightning-caused fires?
That would be a great thing to be able to attribute, what started a particular fire from the fire scars. Unfortunately, we can't. But in our paper, we do spend a lot of time trying to make clear the many ways in which Native Americans used fire on this landscape and the incredible breadth of seasonality and locations where they would use fire across that landscape. And we got review from the Grand Ronde tribes, Siletz tribes, and Frank Lake of Region 5. He actually is with the Pacific Southwest Research Station to make sure that we were representing sort of the potential contribution of Native Americans to that historical fire.
Kerry Metland is with the Nature Conservancy, a forest ecologist. We're talking about what the old normal was, what the landscape looked like in the Rogue Basin and perhaps all of Southern Oregon and Northern California, talking about wildfires today. We'll be also joined by Don Ferguson and Marco Bay in just a few moments here on the Jefferson Exchange after a break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, the topic today is fire in the region, a topic we've revisited a lot this year and in past years as well. You can join the conversation if you have questions for our three participants today at 800-838-3760 or by email at jx@jeffnet.org. And just to remind you who's with us, we have Kerry Metland from the Nature Conservancy, Marco Bay from the Lomacotse Restoration Project, and Don Ferguson, who just retired, actually didn't just retire. They keep bringing him back from retirement, many, many years, 50 to be exact, of working with wildland fire for the BLM and the Forest Service. Don, I want to start this segment talking to you. And it seems to me, I've been around here a long time, and I've lived in the West for almost 50 years myself. And when I was a kid, forest fires were comparably rare, much smaller. Is that just the fog of my memory, or did you experience that as well?
I rely on folks like Kerry to come up with the actual numbers. So anecdotally, experientially, when I started out in fire, it was very unusual to go to a fire larger than 5 or 10,000 acres. My experience now is that 5 or 10,000 acres a day is a reasonable rate of growth for a large fire on the landscape once the fires get established. So I would say larger fires, clearly we have longer fire seasons. And the seasons that we have used to be right here in the Rogue Valley, you'd go 4 or 5, 6 years without serious long-term smoke impacts in the valley. And, in the last 6 years, we've had 3 of extended serious smoke impacts to the valley. Those are new things to me.
And when you first started in wildland firefighting, were you actually on the ground, or were you always in the back office doing information like
you know,
are now?
Everybody starts as a shovel operator. That was me. And I did that for a long time. And about half of my career was as a prescribed fire specialist, so lighting fires. And the other half was trying to put them out.
Hopefully not the same fire.
Sometimes it's the right. same fire.
So what, when you started, what was the philosophy of fighting fires at the federal level?
You know, when I started back there when fire was invented, we still had what they called the 10 a.m. policy, which was it was policy to work your hardest to extinguish every fire before 10 o'clock the next day. And, you know, we were successful keeping fires small. Each year, firefighting becomes more expensive. Fires are larger on average. And that's the trend in my experience. In the last 10 years or so, I've moved into just dealing with public information and helping people adjust their expectations and react to fires that are threatening their communities.
So nowadays, even with a massive response, which sometimes is, well, oftentimes is not possible just because of logistics, there's no way to do a 10 a.m. philosophy anymore, is there, with the size of these fires we're seeing?
No, you know, and we have an increasing resistance to control in our fires. I'm not saying it was easier to put them out, but we were more likely to be able to attack fires directly at the fire's edge. Anymore with the kind of fuel loads we're dealing with, accumulated fuels in the forest and prolonged drought, we have to be indirect in our strategies more often. So we're building a fire line miles away from the actual fire so that we can deal with it on our own terms.
I want to get back to a topic that an idea that Kerry raised in the first part of the segment, which is the frequency that fire returns to the landscape. Because one of the things that I've noticed is that a lot of the mega fires, you know, I think about the Klondike fire right now, which burned up against the Chetco Bar fire and parts of the Old Biscuit fire, and the Old Biscuit fire was burning in parts of the Old Silver fire. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I want to throw this out to everybody, including Marco. You know, are we seeing a difference in the frequency of fire return now versus what, you know, Kerry's study shows? Anybody want to take that?
I'll take that.
This is Kerry Metlin.
This is Kerry, yeah. So basically, there are parts of the landscape that are seeing surprisingly frequent fire now. I think the Biscuit is a great example of that. But an important thing has changed. So we went for a prolonged fire-free interval. And if you look at Figure 1 in the manuscript, what it shows is
I'll hold it up to the microphone.
The severity of a fire or the impact of that fire really matters. It really matters what was there to begin with. So if you have large fire-resistant trees, then a frequent fire regime is not necessarily severe because those trees persist. On the other hand, as we see in some parts of the Biscuit, if the large old trees have been killed, and as we see, you know, in a clear-cut logging, for example, the large trees are missing, then a frequent fire regime can actually be a severe fire regime. And we sort of are seeing this shift away from frequent low-intensity fires that helped maintain forest historically, to now when these fires come through, there are a wide array of effects. In some instances, we're getting some very beneficial ecological outcomes in forests. But then we also see northern spotted owl habitat burning up and, of course, severe impacts to our human communities. And so there's a wide array of impacts. And even though in some places there's more frequent fire than there was for the last 100 years, the severity of that initial fire that's come back after a very long period is oftentimes more severe than it would have been if you'd had periodic fire throughout that time period. And that means subsequent impacts are actually more severe as well.
Now, is that because in those areas where the fire is coming back, we're seeing not so many trees necessarily, but a lot of brush that ends up, of course, the species of brush that grow in our area, you know, manzanita and whatnot, are very, very flammable. Is that what's causing the severity of the fire?
Certainly that's part of it. Brush is, in fact, flammable, although if it's not a very, very dry fire season, fire doesn't actually carry through manzanita very well. But I think more important is what's left behind by that first fire. If you lose the big old trees through fire or clear cutting, then you have the potential for a much more severe fire the next time around. You need big fire-resistant trees on the landscape for forests to persist in the face of frequent fire.
Marco Bay, I wanted to bring you into the conversation here with the Lomakotsi Restoration Project. The Ashland Forest Resiliency Project is using fire somewhat to help reduce the fuel loads in the Ashland watershed. What are you seeing out there when you're actually on the ground working in the woods in terms of potential severity for fires?
Well, initially, to set the stage for the reintroduction of fire, there's obviously several steps that have to occur. Understory thinning to reduce the small trees and brush. But then in some cases, the commercial removal of trees in an ecological way, and then we're proud of that on the Ashland Project as a national model, using an ecological forestry approach.
Those are the helicopters we've been seeing a lot over the years.
Right, the helicopters to reduce impacts to decomposed granitic soils, sensitive soils. So we've been able to set the stage for the reintroduction of fire on the ground, but there's a lot of slash burning that has to occur prior to that. So living in the fire-adapted environment as a community with agencies, partners, we've been able to set the stage for that. It is a dry environment. Fires are becoming more intense, but we're seeing this effort occur in the four directions around us, to the south in the Mid-Klamath. Kerry mentioned our partners from the tribes, the Kadook tribe, how to use that model of life in a fire-adapted environment to be stewards of the land, but also utilize fire in a responsible way to return that human or Aboriginal fire regime, some of these great models we're seeing in the Modoc National Forest with our tribal partners in other places. So focused on a community norm of collaboration and the Rogue Basin Cohesive Forest Restoration Strategy from the Southern Oregon Forest Restoration Collaborative, I feel really sets the stage for ramping up the pace and scale of forest restoration. So when we're talking about reducing fire hazard, fire severity, protecting communities, community infrastructure, we're also thinking about habitats we really are concerned about, we really care about, northern spotted owl habitats, habitats for aquatic species that we want to protect from high severity fire. So being very strategic on dry slopes, on ridges, on southerly slopes, where we invest, using the science that Kerry articulated some of these studies to invest in those strategic areas. We think over time, about 1.1 million acres will need to be treated just in the Rogue Basin, about 55,000 acres a year of investment to get these forests in a place to reintroduce fire and to have our natural resource managers and agencies more effectively manage fire.
We're talking about fire here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation on the phone at 800-838-3760 or by mail. The email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We're going to take a phone call here. This is Derek in Talent. Good morning, Derek.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just a couple comments that I appreciate you expanding on if you're interested. I was in forestry school 20 years ago, and we were complaining about how we were complaining about the 10 a.m. policy and how fire had not been introduced properly into the forests and the suppression problems and the problems that created. And since then, you drive around the woods and you still see huge piles and you don't see much broadcast burning. And so I guess my risk analysis has changed quite a bit as an environmentalist that is greatly concerned about spotted owl habitat, but the threat of losing it all is very disconcerting when you read stories about the Great Burn in 1910, which was pre-suppression, of course. And so I guess I look at the Southern Oregon Forest Restoration Collaborative. I think that's exceptional to be looking at the landscape through an ecological lens and trying to burn so much acreage. And I wonder how you come to your volume estimates on that, and if you could just expand on any of those comments, I would certainly appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Derek. Marco, do you want to take that, or Carrie?
Okay, Carrie. Go for it.
Okay, yep. So this is Carrie Metland again. So I actually was the lead technical author for that particular report. And the way that we got to those volume estimates was using remotely sensed data that told us what's out there in the forest, how many trees per acre of what species. And then we got together as a collaborative, and we talked about what kind of treatments make sense, thinning from below, retaining the biggest trees, right, wanting to set that landscape up to be very resilient. And then we looked across the landscape and we said, okay, what kind of makes sense? We optimized where we would do treatments given our ability to access those areas with existing roads. And we basically did fancy math to say, given what's there, given what we want to achieve, what could we produce as a byproduct of restoration? What's going to come off if we take a restorative approach that might be something we can sell to the mill? That's where we got our volume estimates.
Yeah, so we're looking at 83 million board feet a year in those strategic settings that Carrie's speaking about to increase that pace and scale and achieve those objectives.
So 83 million board feet of timber that could come off the landscape? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, as the byproducts of restoration.
And those would be potentially products that could go to the mills.
Right. And in some places on the landscape, they will pay their way out of the woods. In other places, they will need to be subsidized or with a combination of products that can pay their way out of the woods and products that need to be subsidized. We can come up with a pretty creative equation to successfully implement the work. So we're looking at a 20 to 30 year approach to accomplish this work.
And I'd also like to be clear that, you know, what we're trying to do with that report is a transparent accounting of the the trade-offs inherent in this kind of management. So it's really easy to think about, well, if you want to do fuels reduction, what's it cost per acre,
right,
how many acres you want to treat, and just do that math. But we also built in a quantitative wildfire risk assessment so that we could say, if we invest in this way, these are some of the outcomes we get. So when you look at the overall price tag, it's expensive, but that comes with a 70% reduction in wildfire risk across the landscape, a 50% reduction in wildfire risk to communities, a 50% reduction in wildfire risk to the northern spotted owl habitat, which at the bedrock of the strategy, we actually, the first thing we do is identify the important spotted owl habitat and we protect it. We say we don't do any work there. So I think what we're trying to do there isn't just say how much wood could we get out of the woods. It's
right,
what's the work that needs done? What's it gonna cost? And then what are some of the trade-offs that we might get out of that work?
Don Ferguson, Derek, our last caller, also mentioned when he was in forestry school, they were kind of grousing about the 10 a.m. policy. That clearly is not the policy anymore. How did that change over time when you were in firefighting and the Forest Service and BLM?
You know, there is a broad acceptance of the role of fire in the landscape. People less often refer to the damages of fire. There's more a recognition, especially with lightning fires in fire-dependent ecosystems, fire-generated ecosystems that we have all over Southwest Oregon, that fire plays a very important role there. So there's a little less of an adversarial stance. Fire is not always the enemy. But in most places in Southwest Oregon, because of the checkerboard ownership, particularly in the Bureau of Land Management, the amount of wildland-urban interface we have here, we don't talk much about delayed initial attack or anything. There is more and more urgency to minimize the footprint of a fire.
And is that, I assume that changes if you have a fire like, for example, the car fire, the Delta fire, that get going really close to the urban interface in terms of the the concern that's raised.
Absolutely. This fire that just lit up, the Delta fire, just a couple of days ago, that closed the interstate. Watching that fire develop, it was clear that that fire was driven by dry fuels. There wasn't a lot of wind on the fire, not exceptionally difficult terrain. It went from ignition to 15,000 acres by dark. So that drives our urgency. And, the technical advances in firefighting aren't coming real fast. We can't always just rely on building a bigger airplane or using a different kind of retardant or putting more firefighters on the line. There's diminished returns on that. What we rely on now, John, is it's really delightful when you're working on a fire and you have some control options that were given you by the last team that was there, maybe doing some prescribed fire on the landscape, so that when the fire enters a treated area, you suddenly have a whole new suite of options where you can get up really close to the fire and minimize that footprint.
Go ahead, Marco.
Yeah, just picking up on what Don mentioned on the Ashland Forest Oil Lands Restoration Project. You know, we have a 52,000-acre footprint. We're focused to treat 14,500 acres of that footprint. During the lightning bust in June, we had one of the areas that we treated in the Wagner Creek watershed, lightning strike, on a snag that the landowner and Jackson 5 Fire Department were able to get a handle on that and put that fire out prior to it going to an extreme state. So those treatments have shown effect in other places. In Chiloquin, Oregon, where we recently done treatments, we've seen the same thing where hotshot crews can get on the ground and suppress the fire prior to a larger event. So
we're talking about wildland fire, what was the old normal and what the new normal might look like here on the Jefferson Exchange. And we'll be back in just a moment with more. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter. We're talking with Carrie Metlin of the Nature Conservancy. Don Ferguson, retired. I keep calling you retired, but they keep bringing you back. Don Ferguson has 50 years experience working with federal fire management efforts. And Marco Bay, who is the executive director of the Lomacotsi Restoration Project. Our focus this morning is kind of looking back at what the old normal in terms of fire was in Southern Oregon and Northern California. And Carrie, I want to come back to you and your report, because your report seems to show a major shift in the way fires visited the landscape when European colonization happened in the region, say, starting, I guess, in the middle part of the 19th century.
Absolutely. I think it's actually pretty fascinating. Of course, my perspective is a little biased there. But we show incredibly frequent and sort of reliable fire. Fires were coming, like we said, with a strong central tendency of 8 years and a fairly narrow envelope, a range of variability around that. But then in those places that were closer to settlements, so near Ashland, Eagle Point, and the town of Waldo, which is actually was near Cave Junction, we saw that regular interval all of a sudden get blown up and went to much longer fire return intervals. 1852 in the site that's nearest to Ashland, mid-1850s at those other sites. And what that says is actually there was a settlement that was happening at that point, but also the forced displacement of Native Americans. And so there's a lot of factors that come into play there all at once. You have your Native American ignition suddenly go away. You have widespread grazing across the landscape. You have incidental fire control, as people are finding it actually quite easy to put out fires, and maybe they come from a different culture, and they think those fires should be put out, so they do. And then disruption of the fuels with agriculture. So a number of factors come into play right there in the mid-1800s. Now, that said, at our more remote sites, so we have a site, for example, up on top of Elliott Ridge over above Squaw Lake at the top of the Applegate. And fires continued at a regular interval there until 1906. So we have this sort of phased period of fire exclusion that really focuses on the settlements and then becomes more complete as we get a broader Euro-American impact and more effective fire suppression as well.
Well, Don just mentioned that in some ways, fire suppression technology has not changed a lot over the years. But I would imagine back in the 1850s, obviously there are no air tankers, there are no helicopters with buckets, there's no infrared imaging at night, but still the settlers were fairly effective at putting out fires, apparently.
They were, and actually there are some interesting stories of like a mule and a wet rope, right? And like dragging the wet rope across the pine litter because the forests were much more open. There were a lot fewer small trees, but also fewer shrubs. We actually have a quote in the paper from General Joseph Lane, who was responsible for rounding up and getting rid of the Native Americans. As part of that, he spent a lot of time riding through the forests of southern Oregon. In 1880, he was being interviewed about changes he'd seen, and he noted that the hilltops that used to be covered in grasses and herbaceous foliage were now covered in dense brush by the 1880s. So we had a very different fuel scape when we had those frequent fires.
So that was over a period of just maybe, 20 or 30 years then?
Absolutely. And a primary complaint that I hear again and again being lobbed at our federal partners is that if they do a treatment, well, are they going to maintain it? And the concern, and you hear this legitimate concern everywhere you go, is if you go in and you reduce the fuels, then within 10 to 20 years, lo and behold, you're going to have a fuels problem again. And I think it's really interesting how that fits within the envelope of historically frequent fire.
So a common complaint that we've heard over the past, 4 or 5 years is, oh my God, the smoke. I can't deal with the smoke. Did your research show anything about what the possible levels of smoke would have been when, before fire suppression, and before Euro-American settlement, when there were more frequent fires but they were lower intensity? I mean, was smoke available or present, I should say, more parts of the year but maybe less intense? Is there any way to tell that?
Well, first, I'll just simply say there are some records, and we went into newspaper clippings. So we have newspaper records, for example, in Ashland that go back to, I think, the 1860s. And so you can have comments about the fires and the smoke and some comments about, ooh, it's bad. You obviously don't have an air quality index to compare it to. But what I would say is then, just to shift slightly on the perspective, we know the fuels are very different than they were then. And we also have really good evidence that says prescribed burning, which consumes fewer of the fuels, releases way less smoke, way fewer pollutants that cause, irritation to our sensitive cells, than does wildfire. And so we can say that if we gradually reduce those fuels across the landscape, then when fires burn, they actually do release less smoke.
And Marco Bay, your project has been doing some prescribed burns in the Ashland area. I've seen them from my house. And do you get some pushback from the general public about, hey, I have to deal with this in the summer, and now it's April or May, and I don't want to breathe the smoke now, too?
Right. So, yeah, our collaborative partnership under the leadership of the Forest Service and the City of Ashland, actually, and the Nature Conservancy in Lomakotsi, our four partners and a whole wide array of other partners, contractual partners, trying to get fire back on the ground is definitely a challenge. Speaking with Don Ferguson this morning, it's one of the most difficult places to get fire on the ground in this air quality index. I think the public and a lot of the outreach and work of our partnership to inform the public and dialogue with the public about the need to maintain these forests with prescribed fire, based on what Kerry just mentioned, and the different flavor of smoke and the particulate matter, is an uphill battle. But at the same time, folks are seeing it with the summer like we just had, with the smoke in our lives in this fire-adapted environment. We're going to have to figure out a solution. There's a growing support for prescribed fire. The prescribed fire training exchange has come to Ashland 3 times. That prescribed fire training exchange is occurring across the West, trying to bring those resources together, increase prescribed fire, and inform the public of that need of prescribed fire. We live in this fire-adapted environment. It's part of our daily lives. It'll be part of our life in the summer. And getting a handle on it in the spring and fall are going to be really important to protect our communities and hopefully in the long term, in the 20 to 30 year trajectory, reduce that smoke if we increase the pace and scale of forest restoration.
I think Paul Hesburgh in the Era of Megafire said it pretty well. We actually don't get to choose if we get smoke. It's going to happen. We're going to get smoke. But what we can have some influence over is how we get that smoke.
I actually had a discussion with somebody who was not Don, but had pretty close to his number of years in firefighting. And he said to me at one point, he said, listen, if you don't like forest fire smoke, don't live in the West. And at the time, that seemed kind of like a very direct and almost sort of cynical comment, but I'm seeing the wisdom of it a little bit, having breathed the smoke here for 6 weeks this summer in Ashland. Don Ferguson, I know you're not involved in federal forest policy at this point, but as an observer, do you see it even more difficult at the federal level to get a change in perspective in terms of putting fire back in the landscape as a management tool?
You know, I believe, like Derek, the caller earlier, he said it makes him nervous when he drives through the woods and there hasn't been fire there. I think more people are kind of coming to that recognition, too, that if you're driving through the woods and you see the little black skirts on big old trees and you know that fire has been there in the last few years, there's a vibrancy and a sense of security in the forest for me there. I think a lot of folks in the public maybe on the edge of coming to that same recognition, to where a burned area aesthetically, for a couple of years, it kind of hurts to look at it. You know, our lives are so short in terms of how many fires we get to see. But if you go look at an area that was burned 5 or 10 years later, when the number and kinds of things living there is taken off, I think Yellowstone is a good example. People felt the loss of a great national treasure there when so much of Yellowstone was burning. Within a couple of years, the elk, wolves, large ungulate population, birds had increased so rapidly that folks maybe feel a little less threatened by the fire. I would say, I was telling Marco and earlier today that out of 10 days when the fuels are in the right condition where you could get the desired intensity of your fire, maybe one of those days is socially acceptable in terms of putting smoke into the shared air. That's the big constraint. You can't sell smoky air to people very easily. You can sell prescribed fire if they don't have to breathe it.
We're talking about fire here on the Jefferson Exchange. Don Ferguson, a longtime participant in the firefighting efforts at the federal level for the BLM and the Forest Service. Kerry Metlin, who's a forest ecologist with the Nature Conservancy, and Marco Bay from the Lomacatse Restoration Project are our guests. You can join the conversation by calling us at 800-838-3760, or you can hit us with an email at jx@jeffnet.org if you have a question. One other thing that I found striking in reading your report, Kerry, was the timing of the fires that you saw prior to Euro-American colonization. It wasn't just in the summer, was it?
Absolutely. I think this is actually one of the most exciting things that we found. So when a fire burns by a tree, it causes a little scar. And as it turns out, you can actually tell the seasonality of about 2/3 to 3/4 of those scars, based on if it burned in the white part of the wood, the dark part of the wood, or sort of in between. And so we can then look at the physiology of trees and get an idea for if fires burned broadly in the spring, summer, or fall. And what we saw is that historically, less than half of the fires burned in the summer, with over half of them burning in the fall, and a smaller proportion, about 1/4, burning in the spring. And so what that says to me is that you've got a much broader array of potential for different kinds of fire, because if fires are burning when fuels are more moist, nights are cooler, you have, you know, less convective heating because it's no longer the heat of the season, you have the opportunity for more fire that actually maintains forests. And if you compare then to our current fire, so I downloaded the data from Oregon Department of Forestry, looked across Jackson and Josephine County. If you look at the acres burned, over three-quarters of the acres burned are in the peak of the fire season, when it's hot, and a very, very tiny sliver in the spring, because that's when it's easy to put fires out. And so what I would propose is that could give us some guidance for thinking about how do we want to restore these landscapes and sort of driving home the reality. There's a huge opportunity on the shoulder seasons for cool burns that maintain forests and protect communities.
We hear about inversions in the summertime, and sometimes those inversions help damp the fires down a little bit, although they make it more difficult for aerial attacks on fires. But we are prone to inversions as well in the wintertime here. And I can remember, you know, back in the 1980s in the Rogue Valley, for example, before there was inspection and maintenance of vehicles and when wood stove use was in much greater, we'd have terrible, terrible air in the wintertime. And late fall, early spring, occasionally as well. Does your data indicate anything about what the weather was like? In the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s, was there more mixing of the air so that those fires, the smoke from those fires, would dissipate a little bit easier?
I have no way to ascertain that. But what I would say is that with prescribed burning, you can do a better job of deciding when you're going to light that fire based on weather predictions, and thus do a better job of ensuring that that smoke will disperse better than if you're simply waiting for it to happen at a time when you can no longer put it out, at which point then you have more emissions and also you're more prone to those inversions.
Very quickly, I want to get back to Marco Bay. We just have about 45 seconds. What are you guys going to do going forward in terms of this new regime of treating the landscape?
Well, this is occurring, across the West, obviously, these efforts as part of the Rogue Basin cohesive strategy with the Southern Oregon Forest Restoration Collaborative and our partners. The goal would be to actualize that strategy across the Rogue Basin to increase this work. We're looking at a lot of triple bottom line benefits in addition to forest resiliency and community wildfire protection, estimated 1,700 direct and indirect jobs, $63 million in local wages. It's all been analyzed. So building that community infrastructure to implement these restorative treatments to take care of the land and the communities. That's our focus.
Great. Thanks very much. That wraps up the Jefferson Exchange for today. Marco Bay, Kerry Metlin, and Don Ferguson, thanks very much for being with us.